You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
How often do you click on links to articles online beginning with the words, "A new study finds"? Whether they involve sleep and sex, alcohol and chocolate, there are countless reports that reveal the benefits of one and decry the deadly risks of another. Well, here to shed some light on bogus studies, celebrity wellness trends, and fake health news is health policy expert Tim Caulfield, the Canada Research Chair in Health and Law and Policy, and a professor in the Faculty of Law at the School of Public Health in the University of Alberta. His most recent book is called "Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? How the Famous Sell Us Elixirs of Health, Beauty, and Happiness." It's published by Beacon Press and brings Professor Caulfield to our show now. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Just last week, the New York Times published a story titled, "Is Alcohol Good for You? An Industry-Backed Study Seeks Answers." And Gary Switzer of healthnewsreview.org found that the alcohol industry funded not only the NIH study that was referenced, but also pointed journalism workshops. Isn't that a major conflict of interest?
Yeah, it sure is. And it's a really good example of one of the twisting forces that can affect what we hear about health science. It's really everywhere. I call it a hype pipeline or a twisting pipeline. There are all these subtle forces that really start at the stage of basic research, and then it moves on to the publication. There's a little bit of publication bias, and then you have funding bias, like you just described, and then you have press releases coming from the universities that add a little bit more spin. And then it gets to you guys, right, the media, and you get a little bit more spin there. It becomes really difficult to tease out the truth.
Should journalists just ignore them or pick and choose?
That's a great question. In fact, I know some colleagues have suggested that all single studies should be ignored, right? Because that's one of the things that people should be aware of. Especially when you're talking about health, which is so phenomenally complicated, you really need a body of evidence, and very rarely is one study, even a big study, going to give you a definitive answer. So some people have argued, and I'm not sure I totally agree, but some people have argued that journalists should ignore these single studies and just focus on the systematic reviews and the meta-analysis and the recommendations coming from respected sources. So, yeah, I mean, that's something that people have suggested. Ignore those single studies.
How common is it for industries to fund studies and news reports? And is there a way to tell which studies are truly independent?
It's very common for industry to be involved. And let's be fair here, Leonard. We need to involve industry so often, right? We need industry to translate a lot of the innovations that come from university research, that come from independent research. So it is a real challenge. And increasingly, researchers, and I've experienced this myself, are pressured to partner with industry because that's where we need to get research funding from, as government sort of curtails the public funding for research. So it is a real challenge, but I think that people should be aware of the bias that industry can have, and now increasingly there are more stringent disclosure rules. So you can actually go to the paper and find out who has funded it, and that helps a lot.
And then yesterday, several major news outlets, NBC, CNN, The New York Times, all reported on new studies which found that drinking more coffee can lead to a longer life.
Now, I love coffee, so my cognitive biases are all in on this one. So I think that that's another really good example of, I can remember coffee was bad for you, right? You were supposed to avoid coffee. Now coffee's good for you. You saw, wine was good for you forever, right? And now studies are coming out to say wine might be bad for you. So you have this kind of fluctuating story emerging in the popular press, and that can confuse the public. And there's actually interesting studies that show that it does have that impact, that people feel confused when they see these conflicting stories. Their trust goes down, and they feel more uncertain about the decisions they're making about their health, which is really unfortunate because, there is good evidence-based approaches to living a healthy lifestyle.
Well, though, for many of us, we just see the headline and don't even bother reading the story, and that's what sinks in. Kelly McBride, the vice president of the Poynter Institute, told The Atlantic in a recent article that there's more bad health news out there than there is in any other category, and reliable sources on other topics are sometimes really bad on healthcare news. Do you think that's the case?
Yeah, you know, I saw that myself, and I think it's a really good point. And those of us who have been working in the area of health policy, you know, I've been in this area for decades, you know, have seen this fake news phenomenon unfold. I mean, it's really been a big part of our life for a long time, and now we're starting to see that same kind of approach permeate other parts of society. But yeah, I think that commentary is correct. There is so much noise out there, and part of it, you know, it comes from the research institutions, and I'm not saying that there's an organized effort to deceive the public, but there are just all these systemic forces out there. You know, we've talked about one of them, you know, this pressure to translate, this pressure to get technology and innovations into the clinic, pressure to get research grants, pressure to publish. All of those kinds of things can subtly twist what we hear about science and what makes us healthy.
I'm speaking with Tim Caulfield. His latest book is Gwyneth Paltrow, Wrong About Everything, How the Famous Sell Us Elixirs of Health, Beauty, and Happiness. What makes something a pseudoscience? You've been critical of naturopaths, for example. Is that a pseudoscience?
Well, I have been critical of naturopaths. And for me, and there's actually an ongoing debate about the term pseudoscience. Some people feel it's too pejorative, right? And it's a sort of a polarizing term. But I think it's fair game. So for me, pseudoscience is something that is portrayed as if it is scientific, right? Even though it's scientifically implausible. So for me, homeopathy is a really good example of something that's pseudoscientific, where there is, it's, you know, I don't know if your listeners know homeopathy. It is often confused with natural health products, but homeopathy is, you know, scientifically absurd, right? It's physically impossible to work. It's in the category of flying carpets.
You know, it's about diluting something to the equivalent of one molecule, but the thing that you want to fight.
That's exactly right. You know, you take a substance, a root or a herb or, you know, whatever, and then you put it in water and you dilute that substance to nothingness. And the idea is that the water will hold the memory of that substance, and then you consume it, and it's supposed to heal you, and it has all these other kind of strange supernatural foundations to it. But it's absurd. And that's something in our own research has found, at least in Canada, that's one of the most common remedies provided by naturopaths. So, you know, they also do detoxification, no evidence to support that. They do this IV therapy with vitamins, etc., as a detoxification approach. No evidence to support that. Ionic foot baths, no evidence to support that. On and on and on. But they're all presented as if they're kind of science-y. And I think that's problematic, and I think that is misleading.
But there are people who use homeopathy and go to naturopaths who will tell you that treatment worked while the traditional treatment didn't work. Is this just a matter of the placebo effect?
Well, I think there's a lot of factors going on here. You know, so you have what's called regression to the mean. You know, so this is a common phenomenon. Let's say you have an ailment, and you know, you go to your family doctor and it doesn't help. Then you go to a specialist and it doesn't help. And then you try an alternative practitioner, and then you get try a really way out there alternative practitioner, and lo and behold, you're better. Right? What happened was you got better on your own, and the last remedy that you took, let's say homeopathy, is the one that you remember and you attribute the benefit to that. So this, you create this causation. So that's regression to the mean. Also the placebo effect and the placebo theater created by these practitioners. Now I've tried a lot of this stuff. I've tried, you know, acupuncture and cupping, and I've gone to a naturopath. Almost without exception, Leonard, an incredibly positive experience. These were caring people that listened to me. They spent time with me. And that helps, and that's meaningful, right? So I think we can learn from that. You know, what's missing from conventional practice, from science-based practice that these alternative practitioners are providing? I think there's an important lesson there.
Some cancer patients seek out alternative treatments and holistic solutions that appear to be effective. Steve Jobs reportedly lived for 20 years with a rare form of pancreatic cancer that he treated with alternative medicine. So how do we know which treatments may actually have some legitimacy?
Well, we know using the scientific method, right? And a lot of these things, you know, claim, you know, I hear this all the time, as you can imagine. I get a little bit of hate mail in my life. I hear this all the time, and people will say, you know, this works for me, or how do you know it doesn't work? And where is the evidence to support your position this doesn't work? Well, very often, we have the evidence. You know, there's been clinical trials that have shown that this doesn't work. Also, there's this scientific plausibility factor, and I think that's really important and often overlooked. And we also have to remember that an anecdote, even a powerful testimonial, and that's where celebrity culture comes in, right, is not evidence, right? That's an anecdote. In fact, the scientific method is created to cut through that noise, right, to cut through that noise of personal experience to give us an objective take on reality. And when we use that, it often tells us it doesn't work. And to be fair, a lot of conventional medicine doesn't work. We have to remember that, right? So, yeah, we can use the scientific method to discern whether something works or doesn't work, and we can use scientific plausibility to critically analyze the claims.
Didn't you recently publish a study about naturopathy in Canada and the science of vaccines, which found, among other things, that of 330 naturopath websites analyzed, 40 included vaccine hesitancy discourse, 26 offered vaccine or flu shot alternatives? Why did you decide to do a study on naturopaths and vaccines?
Well, you know, the vaccination is an area that our team is really very interested in, because it's a good example of the incredibly detrimental impact that this whole discourse can have, right, on public health and on individuals' lives. We see the measles outbreak in Europe right now that can be largely attributed to anti-vax rhetoric. We thought it was really important to map out where this rhetoric was coming from. And we think that the complementary alternative medicine community is part of the story. Now, let's be clear, not every alternative medicine practitioner is anti-vax. On the contrary, but there is evidence that says that many of them are, and many people who are anti-vax are attracted to that community. Many families are. So we thought it was really important to get a sense of what was out there. And yeah, we found that there was a lot of anti-vax, and our criteria was quite strict, Leonard. You know, these were websites that talked about the myth about a connection between autism and vaccination. No evidence to support that at all, and also offered homeopathic alternatives to vaccination. Right. So this isn't sort of equivocal stuff. This is stuff that was clearly anti-vax, and a lot of that was there. And the other reason that we wanted to do it was to also talk about regulatory strategies that we could use to stop this.
My guest is Timothy Caulfield, who has written for Time, Newsweek, Wired, National Geographic, Scientific American, author of The Cure for Everything, Untangling Twisted Messages About Health, Fitness, and Happiness, and the book we are discussing right now with what I described as a very provocative title, Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? How the Famous Sell Us Elixirs of Health, Beauty, and Happiness, published by Beacon Press. We'll take a little break, and when we'll come back, we'll talk about some of those celebrities and what they are claiming. Stay with us for more. We're back with Tim Caulfield, the Canada Research Chair in Health, Law, and Policy, professor in the faculty of Law and the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta in Canada. His most recent book is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything, How the Famous Sell Us Elixirs of Health, Beauty, and Happiness. It's published by Beacon Press. Vani Hari, the creator of the Food Babe blog and a crusader against chemicals, has also made many scientists angry. They believe her claims are inaccurate or even dangerous. She argues that food, water, are all potential sources of toxic chemicals. Isn't any substance toxic at a high enough quantity?
Yeah, that's right. That's one of the sort of truisms of chemistry. You know, the poison is really in the amount, the dose, right? It's not. There's toxins everywhere, and this is a really common theme that we see in popular culture, right? This fear of toxins. You know, Gwyneth Paltrow talks about it a lot too, and this chemophobia, this that we're supposed to avoid chemicals. And the food babe actually said, you know, quote I often use is that she claims that we should avoid all chemicals. There's no acceptable amount of chemicals that we can ingest, which of course is an absolutely absurd comment because the entire world is made up of chemicals. You know, an apple is made up of chemicals. So there is this kind of language that's used in this community, and it has intuitive appeal, right? You know, who wants toxins in their body? Who wants chemicals in their body? So it gets a lot of traction.
Well, isn't there evidence, particularly in communities near former industrial sites, EPA Superfund sites, for example, of cancer clusters and diseases caused by contamination from chemicals? So ideas about toxins and contamination can't be all wrong.
Oh, that's right. That's exactly right. And it's those kinds of stories, right, that give the word toxin its power. Absolutely. You know, we have to be sure that the water we drink is safe, and we have to make sure that the food that we buy at the grocery store have acceptable levels of pesticides on them, for example. But if you look at the studies and you look at the research, right, almost always that's the case, right? In, you know, pesticides on our vegetables and fruit, for example, is a good example of how, in general, their pesticide residue is extremely low, right? And we should really be worried about the big picture, eating lots of fruits and vegetables, not the things that, you know, the food babe talks about. You know, for example, she recommends drinking only raw milk if you can, which is an absolutely ludicrous suggestion, right? It's, you know, spectacularly wrong. You know, raw milk is far more dangerous than pasteurized milk.
So you were not concerned when EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt rejected a ban on the use of the pesticide chlorpyrifos this spring? It potentially causes developmental damage to children, vomiting, and dizziness in adults.
Yeah, no, I'm not. You know, it's funny because this is obviously, I shouldn't say it's funny, this is the often the kind of thing that you hear back, that somehow if I am, you know, against the use, inaccurate use of the word toxin, or if I'm against the sort of the absurd use of the word chemical, that somehow I'm against, you know, doing this kind of investigation. I'm not. You know, we have to be vigilant, and we have to be sure that the toxin levels are appropriate and safe, and that the kinds of chemicals that we're using, for example, in agricultural production are safe. You know, that we should be careful about that. But pop culture, the celebrity culture, the kinds of things that you're hearing from Gwyneth, from the food babe, from Jessica Alba, are really fear-mongering, right? And they're trying to create this fear that there's all these dangers around us all of the time. And I think there's evidence to suggest that that kind of rhetoric distracts us from the core things that we can do to live a healthy lifestyle. And, of course, some of this stuff is expensive, too. We have to remember, they are marketing products. They're marketing a brand, and creating fear about toxins and chemicals is part of that brand.
Dr. James Hamblin, a senior editor at The Atlantic, wrote that people like Vannie Harry, the food babe, speak to people in a way that resonates, and that analytically minded people, her scientists, critics among them, often with big health ideas of their own, might do well to understand why and how these messages work. So can academics and researchers learn something from celebrities like Dr. Oz and Vannie Harry in terms of how to communicate complex ideas to the public?
Yeah, I agree with James on this. And I think that, you know, look, celebrity culture isn't going away. Social media is not going away. It clearly has a profound impact on the way people think about health. And there's lots of evidence to, you know, we haven't talked about that. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that. So how can we use that? What can we learn from them? And one of the big things we've already kind of touched on in a little bit, you mentioned it, is these are powerful stories, right? These are powerful stories. And there's evidence to talk about the power of the narrative, right? The power of the anecdote. Almost without exception, what celebrities do is they tell you a compelling story, right? And that compelling story can have more power than a mountain of data. For example, you know, Jenny McCarthy tells this really moving story about her child getting autism from vaccination, right? And from a vaccination. And that story overwhelmed, you know, the Mount Everest size pile of data that says that routine vaccinations are safe and effective. So I think we need to learn from that. We need to learn how to use narratives, storytelling, creative communication strategies to get across the science.
But Jenny McCarthy was touching a nerve in a lot of people who noticed that after their 18-month-old child had been given the MMR vaccine, not separated, but all as one vaccine to an 18-month-old child, that the child changed and that suddenly they started seeing signs of autism. So that's why people reacted that way. If it was just her case, they probably wouldn't have.
Well, you raise another excellent point, another force that is at play here, and that's the causal illusion, right? So people have an event occurs, and humans are causation machines. You know, our brains are designed to see causation because evolutionarily that was an advantage, right? You know, you eat that plant, you get sick. Don't eat that plant. So what happens here is an event occurs, getting vaccination, and then they start to see signs of autism, and they draw a conclusion. And of course, there's huge other variables at play, right? You know, that could have caused that outcome. And studies have demonstrated that there is no connection, right, between getting a vaccination and autism when you do the sort of the objective analysis. So this is the causal illusion at play, right? And it impacts our lives all the time.
Gwyneth Paltrow launched her high-end wellness and lifestyle company, Goop, in 2008. And she's built a brand largely on the notion that practically everything is bad for us or is slowly poisoning us: sugar, gluten, coffee, sunscreen, even underwear. So what's the harm if she wants to sell a bag of medicine rocks for $85 on her website or packets of vitamins and supplements that are reportedly sourced from ancient Ayurveda?
Well, I think, you know, there is real harm there, you know, because some of my critics have said, look, you know, it's a lifestyle brand, she's having fun, you know, lighten up. Look, she can have a real impact. First of all, we have to remember that celebrities do have an impact, even on an unconscious level. You know, we may not think they impact us, we may think it's just our silly neighbor, but just by keeping these myths alive, if there's misinformation alive, it can have an impact. It's called, you know, the mere exposure effect. You know, there was an interesting study that came out very recently that found that being exposed to fake news can have an impact even if you know that it's fake news, right? Because just that keeping those myths alive, it seems slightly more plausible. And celebrities do that, right? So when she talks about detoxification, when she talks about crazy diets, when she talks about the evils of toxins, that creates that helps keep them those scientific myths alive. So I think that, you know, in the big picture, she can have a real harm on the way we think about her health.
I'm speaking with Timothy Caulfield. His latest book is called Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? It's published by Beacon Press. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Who is Gwyneth's advisor, Dr. Alejandro Junger? And what did he tell you about adrenal fatigue?
That's right. I had the opportunity to meet with him in L.A., and I talked to him about his philosophy on health. And, you know, he very much believes a lot of the things that we've just been talking about. You know, he believes that that we need to detoxify our bodies. He told me I should get a colonic, and that people should get colonics as often as possible, which is, of course, just an enema, and you do not need to do that unless there's a medical reason for getting an enema.
That's all part of the whole cleansing thing?
That's right. It was a whole part of the cleanse, and I actually tried the Gwyneth cleanse. It was 21 days, and holy cow, was it ever difficult? Gwyneth is tougher than I am. No coffee for 21 days. No evidence to support that at all. You know, the word detox is something that people should use as a marker for quackery. There's really no evidence that you need to detox in the way that these people are suggesting. And Dr. Junger very much was pushing that, and it's also this idea of adrenal fatigue, that somehow, you know, our adrenal glands get worn out from coffee and from stress, and that we need to go on this detoxification regimen in order to reset our adrenals. And again, no evidence to support any of that. And this is a really good example of that, what I call science exploitation, right? They use these sciencey terminology that kind of have an intuitive appeal that make it seem legitimate, right? Make it seem plausible when in fact there's no real science there.
Are there similarities between the various cleanses, the one that Gwyneth Paltrow recommends and the one that Katy Perry endorses?
Oh, there's all these. There's so many cleanses out there. There's like the tea cleanse. There's like the sauna cleanse that you can go on. There's even, I'm not making this up, there's even a beer cleanse. I mean, there's a cleanse for everyone. And they all, you know, do have, some of them are quite extreme, right, like Gwyneth. Others are just, I think, trying to use this social fad that's going on right now to sell products. So there's a lot of variation, but at their core, they're all about removing toxins. They're all about resetting your system. They're all about removing chemicals from your body, and they're really all about pseudoscience.
And helping you lose weight.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, that's a really good point because that's often the real goal, right? But it's not sold that way. You know, I recently did a Google Trends search and found that people are searching for dieting less, right? So you can see the dieting line go down, but people are searching for the word detox and cleanse much more. So it's an interesting sociological phenomenon that this idea of detoxing and cleansing are kind of overtaking dieting, when really it's about dieting. The whole, you know, you can bundle them all together. You lose weight on these detoxification regimens because they're crash diets. You know, often there's very little calories involved. You know, I experienced it. I lost a lot of weight very quickly, all came back on. But that's often really what's at the core.
What about juicing? Is there any evidence that juicing actually promotes vitamin absorption and weight loss?
No, I don't think so. And juicing is fascinating a phenomenon, right? You know, it's become an industry. And there really is no evidence to support the health benefits of juicing. If people enjoy juicing, I don't think there's anything inherently unhealthy about it. But keep in mind, it's often high calorie, lots of sugar in there, not as satiating as eating the actual fruits and vegetables that are in your juice. You know, why not just eat all those fruits and vegetables? But it, again, it's being sold, you know, this healthy notion, right? You know, this health halo associated with juicing, and also sold on this idea that it, you know, can detoxify your body and get the vitamins into your system faster. You know, why do we need to get the vitamins in our system faster? Why is that a better route? Never explained. Again, just playing on the intuitive appeal of the product.
Well, talking about industries, you also investigated the massive $80 billion skincare market and $300 billion anti-aging industries. Why do you say that celebrities are at once the victims and generators of beauty myths?
You know, and I did have the opportunity to talk to a lot of people in the industry, and they're under incredible pressure. You know, think of actresses in particular, but increasingly, you know, male actors too. They're under incredible pressure to look younger, to look a particular way. So you can understand why they are willing to try just about anything, right?
Bee venom facials, facial mess made of sheep placenta.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the snail thing. And
good. Let's talk
facial,
about those
Kim
snails.
Kardashian.
The snails on the face, which reportedly leave a trail of mucus that's packed with proteins, antioxidants, and hyaluronic acid, which leave the skin looking glowy and refreshed.
Yeah, that's right. I bet your skin does look glowy with the slime there, but that's about it. That's about it. There's no evidence to support that at all. And I'm amazed, you know, when I started doing research on this, I really thought there'd be a little evidence to support some of this stuff, but it is incredible how evidence-free that whole industry is, the whole anti-aging sort of beauty industry. It's just not a lot of over-the-counter stuff that works.
A listener wants to know if you or your institution receive funding from chemical or food industries.
We don't, and that's a good question. Almost all of the research that we get is funded by peer-reviewed research grants, you know, so not unlike the NIH in the United States. We also are involved with, other research organizations, and I also have received funding from what's called the Trudeau Foundation, which is, again, an arm's-length academic institution that helps fund this kind of research.
Related to the Prime Minister?
To Pierre Elliott Trudeau, not the current, his son, not Justin Trudeau, but it was a foundation that's completely separate from from any political affiliation.
There's been a bit of pushback about acupuncture from our listeners. One points out that it was considered bunk science until a New York Times reporter, James Reston, pretty famous reporter, was treated with it in the 1970s when he underwent emergency open heart surgery without anesthesia, and it was successful. And many other people point out that this thing has been used very successfully in China for millennia.
So acupuncture is an interesting story. Let's first of all talk about the underpinning philosophy there, the idea that there is a life force energy that runs through our body and that there are these meridians that can be manipulated.
And pressure points.
Yeah, pressure points. That's a supernatural idea that has no scientific foundation whatsoever. But, you know, let's keep an open mind. You know, you are sticking a needle into the body that could have some kind of biological impact, right? So it's, again, thinking about scientific plausibility. Perhaps microtraumas there allow inflammation to be healed. Who knows, right? So there have been some studies that have suggested, and if you look at the body of literature, you know, you have these anecdotes that were referenced by your listeners. You know, that's not really good science, but you look at the body of evidence, and there's a lot of research on acupuncture. There have been some studies that have suggested that for things like lower back pain, it is better than placebo. But the better controlled the study, so you have, for example, sham acupuncture, you have a control group, you have real acupuncture, etc. The better controlled the study, basically the effect size shrinks or goes away entirely. So I'm suspicious of it, but I'm open-minded that acupuncture might be slightly beneficial for some things, but we need good clinical trials to back it up.
Are there any chemicals and creams other than Botox that will actually reverse the aging process?
Well, if you're talking about reverse the aging process, if you're talking about wrinkles, there are things, retinol, for example, but in general, you have to get the over-the-counter strength, right? So you have to go to a dermatologist and have them prescribe it. But even with that stuff, the impact is relatively modest, but there are clinical trials that suggest that it can have a visual impact. But again, we're not talking over the counter, we're talking going to a dermatologist and getting prescription strength.
Tim Caulfield is the Canada Research Chair in Health Law and Policy, professor in the Faculty of Law and the School of Public Health at the University of Alberta. His most recent book is called Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? How the Famous Sell Us Elixirs of Health, Beauty, and Happiness. It's published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks very much, Leonard.